the mountain, to the prairie, to the ocean.
With us today is General Lewis W. Walt, formerly Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps. And he's going to tell us what happened in Vietnam and why America faces the problems that it does today. General Walt, can you give us some of your background?
Well, it's rather simple, Doctor. I started out on a farm in western Kansas as one of 13 children. I think the greatest, one of the greatest treasures of my life have been my family. We lost our parents at a rather early age in my life, and the children put each other through school, helped each other get through school. And then I went into the Marine Corps after I graduated from college, expecting only to spend 2 years in the Corps. I thought I'd get the obligation out of the way, and then I could go to my field of chemistry, which I majored in college. But by the time I finished my 2 years obligation, war broke out, World War II broke out in Europe. So I had to stay on in the Marine Corps for a while, and after World War II, I decided I'd just as well make a career out of it, and I did. I stayed in for 35 years in the Corps. I retired in 1971, and since that time, I have continued to be interested in what's going on, not only in military services, but I've gotten more interested in the political areas, which I didn't have time for when I was in the Corps. I had an opportunity to serve as a senior member of the Senate investigation into the international drug traffic, for example, in 1971. And I've been a consultant with elements of the Defense Department since that time. In 1974, I was a member of President Ford's amnesty board, or clemency board, when we were talking about those young men who took off for Canada or refused to go to Vietnam. And it was a very interesting, a very trying year of my life to sit on that board. And today, I'm very much interested in the precarious position that our nation is in, militarily, security-wise. I feel that the way we're going, unless we build up very rapidly, unless we change our course very rapidly, we're going to lose those freedoms, which I have seen so many thousands of young men die for on the battlefield. And it's for this reason, I believe, that I am driven more than anything else of my memory of those men, the oath that they took and carried out, and I feel an obligation to carry out, to continue to carry out my oath to defend those freedoms, and I'm doing it in the best way I know how.
I know you are. You were on Guadalcanal?
Yes, sir. I had the first company of Marines to land at Tulagi, which is the first landing at Guadalcanal.
And then you were in Korea and in Vietnam?
I was in Korea as a regimental commander and chief of staff of the division. And I was in Vietnam as a corps commander for 2.5 years.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened in Korea? I remember reading your book, and General Walt wrote a book. It was called The 11th Hour, and it's his story of his experiences in the military. General, can you tell us about your experiences while you were in Korea, as far as your limitations of your ability to fight effectively under certain circumstances?
In general terms, Korea was the first war that we were in where we were not allowed to win. It was the first no-win war that we were in. The tragic thing was that General MacArthur had the war won and then was ordered to back down. And when I got out there in 1952 as a regimental commander, I was on the demilitarization zone line, so-called, the DMC, and my duty was to protect that line, prevent the North Koreans and Chinese from coming into South Korea. And I was not able to take territory away from the enemy and deny him observation posts and things like that, which would have been a big advantage to us. No, we were not allowed to do that. On the other hand, they were allowed to attack us. So we were actually fighting with two sets of rules. They had one set, we had the other. And it seemed unfair to me at the time. I could not understand it. We were not allowed to go ahead and win the war, which we could have done time and time and time again. And I couldn't understand that. I couldn't understand why we weren't allowed to win in Vietnam. So it was a result of this bothering me, actually, because I saw tens of thousands of young men give their lives out there in those wars, and all for no purpose, because we were not allowed to win. And this kept bothering me after I retired from the Marine Corps in 1971, after having sat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as Assistant Commandant for 3 years. I still couldn't understand why we weren't allowed to win. So here about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I started to do some research, only because I had been asked questions by high school students who I'd been talking to that I couldn't answer. They said, why weren't you allowed to win? Why are we today, is the United States today, in a weakened condition compared to the Soviet Union? And so I said, I don't know. I said, I've got to start research on this, and I did. And the result of trying to answer their questions, I ended up in writing this little book you spoke of, The 11th Hour. And I really do believe that we are living in the 11th hour of our freedoms unless we do something about it.
Well, we hope we can serve to awaken some of the Americans to the real, very real problems that we have. In your book, you told of an instance where you received a reprimand because you used too much artillery ammunition. Could you tell us that story?
Yes, we were limited in Korea in the amount of ammunition we could fire each day on mortars and artillery. And I say we're limited in what we could do in the way of attacking the enemy. For instance, the Chinese had several high pieces of ground out a half or three quarters of a mile in front of my line. They would occupy that high piece of ground. They dug in trenches, and they would fire constantly on my men with mortars, artillery, and small arms oftentimes. And I would prepare a plan whereby I'd go out and take that high ground away from them and drive them off. And then I would get orders. First of all, I had to get the plan approved 24 hours ahead of time by United Nations headquarters. And it seemed that every time we attack those high ground positions, we call them, they were waiting for us. I couldn't understand why. And then after we had taken, after our attack was successful, we immediately got orders to withdraw to our line again where we had started out. And again, the Chinese would occupy that high ground. We were right back in the position we had been in before.
Except you'd lost a lot of men.
Yeah, lost men, and of course we had prevented them building up, and we had to do that. I felt we had to do that, otherwise they would build up such forces that they could overwhelm us with their mass formation. One day in the evening, actually, I got an intercepted radio message, one of my intelligent men, and he thought the message was real. He wasn't sure. He said that the Chinese were going to plan an attack that night, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I believe it was, and they were going to attack the center of my lines. So I thought about this for a while. I said, how sure are you of this message? He said, well, I'm not sure. He said, I only got part of it. I had to piece it together, but this is what I think. I said, well, I'm not going to pass this on to a higher headquarters, because I'm not sure of it. And second, I might be able to surprise them in their attack and really bat them down. Well, I didn't pass it on, but I did alert my forces to be particularly alert that evening. And if the attack was to take, I think, at 1 o'clock, I take place at 1 o'clock, I asked for flares to be dropped from airplanes over my positions and lines. Those flares were dropped at the time the attack was supposed to be taking place, and sure enough, thousands of Chinese were coming across the valley in front of us, rice paddies, into our line. They were about 800 yards from our lines, someplace 600 yards, when the flare opened and showed them up. I opened up with all the artillery and small arms and everything I had on this mass formation. They started running toward our lines. Fortunately, we were able to stop them. They never reached there. But had we not known they were coming, with that mass formation, they would have overrun our lines and if undoubtedly would have killed a lot of American troops. Well, I did fire a lot of ammunition that night, artillery and mortar. And the next morning, I received a reprimand from the higher headquarters about firing so much ammunition. And I tried to explain to them, well, it was for this reason. Well, I still was under a limitation. So instead of getting congratulated for what I had done, I felt that I was reprimanded.
Because we really weren't trying to win.
It seemed like we were playing a different set of rules than I thought we should be playing.
And then you went to Vietnam during the Vietnamese War. And what was your position there?
I was the Corps commander in Vietnam, the I Corps area. My headquarters were in Da Nang. This is the northern one-fourth of South Vietnam, I'm talking about, the first core area, next to the DMZ, next to Laos. And in that position, I was able to constantly watch the DMZ in Laos. I felt that we were fighting two wars in Vietnam. One was against the guerrilla, who had the stranglehold on the civilian populace in the area. The other war was against the North Vietnamese. Their forces, their military forces being sent into South Vietnam for the purpose of keeping us off the back of the guerrilla. Now, this was stated in orders of one of their battalion commanders, which we captured. So they were down there to keep us from interfering with the work of the guerrilla. The guerrilla was trying to take over the control of the populace and turn them into a communist state. I used an awful lot of my manpower. Actually, sometimes nearly a half of my Marines were involved in the villages with the people, rebuilding, helping them to rebuild their schools, their churches. I feel that the guerrilla war in South Vietnam was very much misunderstood or not understood by the American public because they were never told the facts about the case. As I said earlier, the guerrilla, to me, was the man that we had to worry about first because he had the stranglehold on the people. He was one of the trying to convince the people that their government was no good and that they should have nothing to do with the Americans or any other force that came in from outside. And he was himself a native of South Vietnam. He is a young man who had been sent north for indoctrination and training, and he would come back into his own village as a guerrilla. And this made him very effective, of course. Well, as time went on, and I would start using more and more of my forces in the village area, I would send a whole platoon of Marines to live right in the village to protect them against the guerrilla action. We would call these combined action platoons because one platoon of Marines was united with a platoon of South Vietnamese Army forces in that village. They worked together as a team. It gave them the additional support that the South Vietnamese Army forces didn't have. My platoon of Marines, of course, had a battalion back up them if you needed them, and this gave the village a feeling of security, so the people would actually stand up and help us to fight the guerrilla action in their village, because they did not want to become communists. They did not want communism in their village. And for this reason, I say, we used a lot of Marines in the Civic Action Program, which I think was a very effective program in Vietnam. We built churches, or rebuilt their churches for them, or helped them to rebuild. Of course, we never did anything ourselves. We always worked with them. Let them be the force that are doing it. We would help them. We would help them collect their rice crops. Initially, when we got into Vietnam, whenever the rice crops were ready to be reaped, the North Vietnamese, or the guerrillas, would take the rice up to North Vietnam. They'd steal it out of the rice fields. And so we stopped that. We made sure that people in South Vietnam got their rice crops. When the elections would come, the South Vietnamese government tried to hold the elections in the villages. Here again is where the guerrilla would particularly try to interfere. He would try to scare the people, threaten them. For example, we were having an election one time out in a area south of Da Nang. And I went out to visit one of the villages. When I got there, I was talking to the village chief and his wife about the election. They were planning to hold the election the following day, and they were enthused about it. They were going to be able to elect, they helped elect their officials. And they were very concerned. The lady told me that she, her little son, her younger son, 10 years old, had disappeared. They couldn't find him anywhere. Well, while I was talking to that couple, this young boy came running back across a rice paddy toward them, hollering, "Mama," and so forth. And they turned, "Oh, here he comes." And when he got there, he had had both of his hands cut off at the wrists. And there was a sign around his neck threatening his parents and the people in the village that if they dared to go to the voting polls the following day, this or worse would happen to some more of their children. So we were faced with this thing, type of thing all the time. The communist terrorism, they stop at nothing. One night they attack a village, and they killed everyone in the village, over 200 population in a small village. I went out the next morning and visited that village. All the bodies were lying in the streets except the bodies of the small children. Their clothes had been stripped from their bodies, and their little bodies were hung up around the village on fences, with each of them have a sign threatening, again, the other villagers that if they didn't quit cooperating with the American forces and with the Saigon government, this would happen to more and more of their villages. Again, trying to frighten the people of South Vietnam. And I gained a great deal of confidence and admiration for the South Vietnamese people because of all these threats. They still stood up. They still wanted to be a democracy. They still wanted freedom. And that's what hurt me so deeply when we deserted them after they were fighting with us, helping us to attain an objective for several years. Then we went off and left them, and the communists came in and killed, tortured, maimed a lot of these people. For example, one of my orphanages, I say mine, one of our orphanages that we built in Da Nang, we had a total of four orphanages around the I Corps area that we'd helped put together. But this one at Da Nang, I was particularly close to because I would visit it on a weekly basis. I'd talk to the kids, have my pictures taken with them, and really, really enjoyed these orphans. And I was proud because we were teaching them, or the South Vietnamese were teaching them how to be good citizens. And when the big Tet Offensive took place, the North Vietnamese came into Da Nang. They took over this orphanage. They set up machine guns. They called the children out into the area where they had the playgrounds and so forth. They were going to talk to them. They got them out there and machine gunned them down, nearly 400 of them. One of the little nurses escaped. She escaped by swimming in the ocean for pretty near a mile, and she got back as far as Honolulu. And she was trying to tell her story, but no one would accept her story. She wasn't allowed to tell it. And it never got into the news. Even though prominent citizens tried to tell that story, it never got into the news. And I think this is what happened to us in South Vietnam. The media, in many ways, stifled the people who were trying to put the truth out to the American people. So American people never have understood the Vietnam War. We were out there for a good purpose. We were carrying out a good mission. But it wasn't one that we could explain to people back here because they weren't getting the truth about what was going on out there. And I can go on and on and on this story, but I have so many stories, Doctor, I'd rather see if I'm going in the right direction.
All right. Well, you told in your book the story of the Quezon operation, and of course it was billed back in the United States as the American Dien Bien Phu. Can you tell the story about Quezon, how you planned it, and what happened?
Yes, I know Quezon very well. When I first got to Vietnam, it was a special forces outpost of the Army, combination of the American Army and the Special Forces and the South Vietnamese Army. A small camp, I think there were probably 30 people up there. But it was a little village. Quezon is a very small village, and this camp was just outside the village, built in. We had bunkers and things like that, normal special forces camp in that area. I felt it was a very key position because it was in the kind of the funnel that led into the valley that went down into the populated areas in the Way City area and so forth. And I felt that if the North Vietnamese ever came in large forces, they would have to come through that funnel in order to get down, unless they go through the very rugged mountains and jungle, and they couldn't get their weapons through there. They couldn't get their artillery, the tanks and things through there, so they had to come this way. I talked to General Westmoreland, who was the commanding general in Vietnam at that time, and he came up, and we spent all day looking over the Khe Sanh area. We walked the terrain around. We climbed the hill. We looked at it. And he agreed with me. This is the place we should stop them if they try to come in large force from North Vietnam. So we established a larger outpost there. I put a battalion up there, and we dug it in very well. We had a lot of artillery and so forth. And then, of course, when the North Vietnamese made their big attack in South Vietnam, they did try to push two divisions through that area, and the Khe Sanh forces were able to stop them. We stopped them by artillery fire, by air support, and so forth. It was quite effective. We lost, actually, very few people compared to what they lost in those attacks because we were dug in, we had the terrain to our advantage, and it was our plan of defense, and they had to come into it in order to try to drive us out, but they weren't able to. But again, I feel the media misrepresented us there in many ways. They kept saying, we're about to lose Khe Sanh, going to lose, we can't hold it, and so forth. And there was one C-130 aircraft, a big transport aircraft we used up there. This 130 aircraft that was shot down early in the Khe Sanh battle was shown on TV screens every night here in the United States for several days, which gave the impression that we were losing a lot of aircraft in the Khe Sanh battle. We didn't. We lost only the one. But here again, I don't want to appear to be damning all of the reporters and photographers and so forth out in Vietnam. We had a lot of good men out there, a lot of good Americans out there trying to tell the story. But as one group of photographers told me one day when we were discussing this, one of the TV men says, well, General, we take 100 minutes of film out here of all kinds of things, your civic action, everything's going on. But when it gets back to the United States, they select 4 or 5 minutes out of that 100 minutes, and they always select the dramatic part, the bloodthirsty part, and so forth. And said, we have a very difficult time getting the whole story to the American people. So I say that because I do feel that the responsibility of the people here in the United States who select the news to be seen by the American people are the ones who, I say, control the media production to the people of the United States.
But weren't there some actual instances where people distorted the news? You mentioned the story of the burning of the village.
Yes, that is a very true story. It was investigated. I had orders from the White House, Pentagon, Saigon to investigate the incidents. It happened in the fall of 1965, early in the Vietnam War, and I think it was probably in November of 65. There was a village down south of Da Nang, the city of Da Nang, about 5 miles, where the guerrilla, together with the supervision from North Vietnamese commanders, were making this village into a fortified area. They had moved out all the civilians, and they had built pillboxes and fortifications in each house in the village. You couldn't tell it by flying over it. You couldn't tell it unless you walked through it that it was a fortified area. It was very well camouflaged. Well, we found that it was a fortified area, and we found from prisoners that they had planned to use this as a base of attack onto Da Nang. And I gave orders to one of my battalions that we had to go down and destroy that village, or we had to drive the enemy out of there and take possession of it. It took us several days to do that. It took my battalion several days to do that. I lost, I think there's 27 Marines killed in doing this, and a number of others wounded. One day, about noon, I got word that the village had been secured, that the enemy had been driven out. So I said, okay, I'm going to go down and talk to the battalion commander who was there. He wanted me to come down. On the way out to the helicopter, one of the CBS correspondents out there, TV man, said, "Can I ride out with you?" I said, "Certainly." I always made it a point to take the news men and women every place I could to make sure they had a chance to get the story. So we went out to the village. The battalion commander briefed me, told me the story of how he had taken the village and how it cost him and this and that. And he ended up, he said, "General, every one of these huts out here has a pillbox or some type of fortification in them. I would like permission to burn the thatch roofs off of these places, because otherwise they're going to come in and use it again." He said, "I want to dynamite the emplacements and destroy it as a built-up area or as a fortified area." I said, "I see nothing wrong with that. Go ahead and do it." So he turned to one of his company commanders. He said, "All right, go ahead and let's burn the roofs off of these to start with. That'll be the first move." And the company commander turned around to a private first class who was there. He said, "All right," he said, "go ahead and set fire to that roof over there." And the private first class took a cigarette lighter out of his pocket and went over to the roof and lit the roof. Well, this gentleman from CBS took a picture on TV of this young man setting fire to this roof. Well, I didn't think anything of that. I mean, it's all a part of the story. It didn't mean a thing to me. So then about 20 minutes later, this same correspondent said, "Could I borrow a Jeep? I'd like to look around the village a little bit." So he borrowed a Jeep, and with his cameraman and his assistant, I don't know, note taker, I guess, they went over to another village. They got a woman and two children crying. I don't know how they got them to crying, but they were crying, and they had a picture of them. Then they took and put these two together. And in the commentary, said the Marines had burned down the home of this family. Well, of course, I got repercussion all the way back from Washington, trip to the White House about this, and I had to explain it. Well, we immediately started an investigation, which went on for a couple of weeks. I had all the necessary affidavits necessary to prove that the picture was false, that the woman and two children had nothing to do with the village that we were in. And the fact that the reporter got a prize for putting on this wonderful story irritated me a little bit more. But anyway, at the end of the investigation, my Marines were cleared. And there's another thing I would like to mention about South Vietnam that hasn't come up very often. And that is the effect that our missionaries out there had on that country. They did such a wonderful job for so many years. And when I first went into South Vietnam with the troops, I made it a point to meet with these missionaries in the I Corps area about once every 2 or 3 weeks. To me, it was the best source I had of learning what the war was about in Vietnam. They told me their story of how the guerrillas had come into the villages where they would go. And they explained how these young people had taken to North Vietnam and were brainwashed and come back months or even years later, totally changed in their psychological outlook. And it was their help that taught me, actually, or showed me how to deal with the South Vietnamese people. And my troop were very close to the people in the I Corps area. We were very close friends. We were there to serve them. And I think we did serve them in many, many ways. And consequently, they were loyal to us in many ways. I have great admiration for the people of South Vietnam.
Could we have won the war in Vietnam?
We had the war won in South Vietnam. There wasn't any question about that. If we would have stayed there long enough for the South Vietnamese to get their own strength up to where they could protect themselves, they would still today not be in a communist nation like they are.
You mentioned a major, a communist major who defected to you, who told that the real battle was going to be fought in America, not on the fields in the rice paddies of Vietnam.
Yes, this was Major Tang, who turned himself into my headquarters. He brought his wife and child with him. Major Tang was a graduate of a university in France. He spoke good English. He was an operations officer for one of the North Vietnamese regiments. And he turned himself in he said, because he didn't believe that they would be able to win the war in South Vietnam, because we had too many helicopters, too much artillery, too many good supplies, too many people. And I said, well, Major, if you feel that way, why don't your superiors just quit fighting? I'd say, we're not attacking them. North Vietnam is attacking South Vietnam. And if all they have to do is stop attacking into South Vietnam. We weren't allowed to go into North Vietnam at any time, or into Laos. And they would attack us at a time and place of their choosing whenever they wanted. He said, well, he said, that's true. But he said, my leaders feel that they cannot win the war against you under the present circumstances. But they feel that if they will keep the war going on long enough here on the battlefield in Vietnam, that they can win the war, not on the battlefield in Vietnam, but in the psychological and political arena of the United States. And this, again, was early in 1966. And he said, General, you won't believe it now, but I predict that when your Marines and soldiers go home from this war, they will go home not as heroes, but many of them should, but as somebody who had done something wrong. He said, you people in the United States are very naive about the psychological effect that the communist forces have on the people at home. He said, the biggest and most important weapons we have are the psychological weapons. He said, these artillery pieces and tanks and rifles we have out here are literally nothing compared to the psychological weapons that we are using against the American people. And he said, we're going to keep on using them. He said, this will continue on even after the war is over in South Vietnam. If you're going to find your youth are going to be turned against war. And he laid it out just as though he was seeing into the future. And I'm sorry that I didn't make more of that conversation that day than I did.
The real battle then was waged by the mass media, and the battle was waged against the minds of the American public.
That's right.
And they certainly were effective. Why weren't we allowed to win the war in Vietnam?
Because it was not in accordance with the policy of our State Department. Our foreign policy was based on a memorandum, I find in my research from my book, a memorandum that came out of the National Security Council about 1950. Now, this memorandum was first drafted in our embassy in Moscow by Mr. George Keenan, who at that time was charge of affairs to Ambassador Harriman. And Mr. Keenan came back to the United States. He was a special advisor. He became a special advisor to our American, to the National Security Council. And he continued to work on his memorandum. And by 1950, it had been put in final form. It was called the National Security Council Memorandum Number 68. And this memorandum was approved by the Congress and by the President. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time, the military, was opposed to the memorandum because the memorandum, in one of its restrictions was that we would never plan to use nuclear weapons in any war. Well, to the military, this was depriving them of the principal weapon that they had, and the one that had proved to be most effective. But the memorandum in general is a memorandum of appeasement, or a policy of appeasement. And I think you've seen this demonstrated in the no-win war in Korea and no-win war in Vietnam. Actually, in the memorandum, it states that we will never take territory away from the communist nations. We will never attack them, and we will only react to their attacks by counterattacking. That's all. We will react, but we will not go on the offensive against them. And also that we would do everything possible to coexist with them, and that it was believed that if we did this right, eventually we could get together and have a one-world community in which we could get along and we could legislate peace And this is when the Coalition for Peace Through Law was formed. And this coalition believed that we could have a one-world government in which we could legislate peace and prevent any war. Now, this whole coalition, I think, was founded on or caused to come about by three motives. One was a motive of fear. Many of our political leaders feared nuclear war. And because they feared it, they felt we could not afford to ever have another world war. Another motive was a motive of greed. We had many people in this country, industrialists, who had interests in different countries in the world, and they wanted to promulgate these interests. They wanted to have multinational industries in a one-world community. A third motive, I believe, were a group of internationalists who wanted to control the world. They wanted power. And these motives are what has driven our foreign policy in the direction it has gone. And it has gotten us in a position where we are in today, because as a result of this foreign policy, we have unilaterally disarmed our nation. As Mr. McNamara said, we must get our forces down to where the communists won't worry about us attacking them. The Soviet Union won't worry about us attacking them. We must get our forces down to that state. And he wanted to give the Soviets a chance to catch up, and we did. We not only gave them a chance to catch up, we helped them catch up. We've helped them to get ahead of us. We've given them the technology they need. We've given them money that they need or loaned them the money. We've built the largest truck factory the world has ever known up in Siberia. And we have pushed them so hard that now they're considerably ahead of us, and the gap between their capability and our capability is widening every day. And having been in the military all of my life, I talk about capabilities and not intentions. Political leaders often talk about intentions, but I maintain that intentions can change overnight, but capabilities can't. So I'd rather judge my possible opponents on their capabilities than on their intentions.
Well, now, can you tell us a little bit about the strategic imbalance that exists between the Soviet Union and the United States today? First of all, as far as the conventional warfare is concerned, how do our conventional forces compare with their conventional forces?
They're much stronger in conventional forces than we are in many ways. Whether we talk about tanks, we talk about airplanes, we talk about troops, in every field, they are ahead of us and they're gaining every day.
How about tanks? What's the relationship between
us? They have 10 times as many tanks as we do, approximately. And this is just one example. Artillery, the same way.
How about troops? Do you have any?
Yes, they have five times as many troops we have, at least, under training. They're trained troops. They're ready to go. They're ready troops. We don't have today.
How about our rifles? How do our rifles compare with theirs?
Well, that's a very sore point with me. Our rifles in the hands of our infantry today are 22 caliber rifles. Now, 22 caliber is the same type of the caliber rifle we use to shoot squirrels and rats and things like that. It's a varmint gun, literally. A M16 rifle, which was developed for the jungle war in Vietnam, yes. But I've maintained that rifle is totally inadequate for our infantrymen today, because its maximum effective accurate range is 350 meters. The Soviet riflemen, their infantry, have a rifle that is accurate up to 550 or 600 meters. It's a 30 caliber. It is capable of having armor-piercing bullets. The little 22 caliber M16 that we have cannot have a armor-piercing bullet. So I think one of the first things we must do is to get a good rifle into the hands of our infantrymen, one that they have confidence in. The men do not have confidence in the rifle they have today.
Well, now we hear a lot about the dangers of chemical warfare and various types of biological warfare. In fact, hasn't America done away with a lot of its chemical and biological warfare capacity?
Yes, and it's interesting that when President Nixon signed a memorandum which stopped our offensive capability in chemical warfare, destroyed it. I mean, that we will have no more. That was 1969. That very month, the Soviet Union doubled their emphasis in that area. And today, they have a very, very strong capability in chemical warfare, and we have None.
In your book, you mentioned that their tanks were prepared for chemical warfare. In other words, they had filters on them, various and sundry things that would protect their people against the use of biological and chemical things.
That's right, Doctor. Not only their tanks, but their personnel carriers, their anti-aircraft vehicles, all of them. They are prepared to fight on a battlefield where chemicals are used. We are not.
And so if they were introduced, our troops would become totally victimized by these techniques, by
these tools. I visualize, in this case, if the Soviets decided to attack Western Europe, which I think is a possibility, they would lay down nerve gas, probably on our airports and in our headquarters areas, and we would be immobilized.
No real effective means of opposing this.
No.
How do American strategic forces today compare with those of the Soviet Union?
The strategic forces, primarily in the intercontinental missiles, I think it's enough to say that they have a first strike capability in their SS-18 intercontinental missile. They have six times the throw weight capability in missiles that we have intercontinentally. The SS-18 alone, they have 308 of them. This is the big missile. 308 of them, they are authorized. Now, we are not authorized to have any big missiles like this, according to the SALT Treaty, but they are. Why? It's another one of those things that I don't understand about the SALT agreements. They have been given advantages in many areas. With the SS-18 missile that they have, 308 of them, each one of those missiles has the capability of carrying 10 warheads. Each of those warheads will have a explosive capability of 1 million tons of TNT. So one of the big missiles can carry 10 of those. 300 of the missiles can carry 3,000 of them. They can deliver those 3,000 warheads on our country in a period of 30 minutes, if they want to. They can knock out our missiles. They can knock out our harbors. They can knock out our airfields, like that. So this is why I say, I don't think they ever want to do that, no. But they have the capability. I think they want to blackmail us. I think they want us to get us in a position where we have to surrender, because they do have air defense in their country. They do have missile defense in the Soviet Union, strong missile defense, the strongest air defense the world has ever known. And they have civil defense to protect their industries and the people who are working in the industries. We don't have any of these. We have no civil defense. We have no missile defense. We have a very, very slight air defense. We got about 300 old airplanes with no radars to go along with them, so it's practically useless. So here they are. They're not only have they got all the big weapons, but they're armored, they're protected, and we are naked to their attack.
This concept, then, of mutual assured destruction has been accepted by our leaders and has been rejected by theirs?
Absolutely. They talk tough, and they act tough, and they're prepared to be tough.
And we keep backing down again and again and again.
Sir.
Have you had any personal contact with Mr. Henry Kissinger?
Yes, Doctor, I have had. It's been a good many years now. 1960. I was working in the Pentagon at that time. I was a member of a board or a committee that was working on the looking forward to 1980s to see what we thought should be the nature of our armed forces at that time. Mr. Kissinger, or Dr. Kissinger at that time, was a special advisor to President Kennedy. And he used to come in over and sit in with our committee two or three times a week and give us his philosophy on what our armed forces should look like. And each time he would tell us, he said, "Now, don't figure on big armed forces. You're not going to need big armed forces. We're going to maintain peace in this world through economics and diplomacy." Well, we have seen a demonstration of his economics and diplomatic approach, and I think it has left us in a rather vulnerable position insofar as our forces are concerned.
Were there any problems with the distribution of your book, The 11th Hour?
Well, yes. According to my publisher, I keep after him because I can't find it in bookstores, and he said I can't get the distributors to handle it. And I said, "Well, why?" He said, "Well, apparently there's influences above the distributors who don't like to have your book out in public hands. I said, well, what are we going to do about that? And he said, well, we're going to have to go to distribution by mail. My book is a little bit, I guess it's a little bit harsh against the people who are controlling our nation and have controlled it for several decades now. I try to call the shots as I see them. During my 41 years of military service, I didn't have a chance to play any part in the political part of our lives at all. I didn't understand politics. I never got into it. It was after I retired that I started looking into the matter. I tried to find out what is our foreign policy, what are our national objectives, and in researching these things out, I ran into many interesting things that I hadn't known about before, and I put them in my book. And it is not palatable to some people who have behind our government have been, I think, controlling our nation. I really feel that for the last three decades, our nation has been run not by our elected officials, but by other people who are unelected. And I think the term our unelected rulers is a very good term, because I think they've had more than a little influence on our government, on our state, on our foreign policy, and on how, and particularly the economy of our nation. All of which, and I blame these individuals for getting us in the position we are in today, and I blame them in the book.
And who are these people? Who does really control our foreign policy? Who are America's unelected rulers?
They're the elite. They're the elite of our country, the establishment, so to speak, who've had the money, the multinationalists, industrialists, and the internationalists. They have more loyalty to internationalism than they do to our nationalism. They are the people who would give away our Constitution and replace it with a Constitution that I think is very much like the Soviet Constitution. It's a Constitution whereby the people are controlled by the government. That is the purpose of the Soviet Constitution. Our Constitution, of course, is an instrument whereby the people control the government.
Now, I've heard that there is a new constitution that's been written up by Mr. Tugwell, a new plan for a new society in America. Of course, you remember Mr. Tugwell was one of the advisors to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in another era and another time of our society. Are you acquainted with that new constitution?
Yes, I've seen a copy of it. It's called the New States Constitution. It is the next step after the Declaration of Interdependence, which is a declaration for a one-world government. Based on this Declaration of Interdependence, our Constitution would be subordinate to that of the United Nations. And we would lose many of the rights that are laid down in our Constitution. In this New States Constitution, it does away with our state governments. It does away with our right to choose our religion. It's no longer a right, according to that Constitution. It's a privilege which can be taken away from us by our government. The New States Constitution would have us governed not through state government. They do away with the state government. They govern us through 10 regions, which have become called, it has come to be called the regionalism concept.
Is this the concept, then, of regional government that we hear more and more about all the time?
That's right. And such things as ecology and transportation and things like that are already divided into regions rather than by state.
Then you feel we're moving towards this new concept of regionalism, regimentation, and increasing control over our lives?
That is right. And we're moving, and this force is moving us toward a one-world government where we are going to lose our freedoms. Now, initially, I think the people who have been pushing this idea thought that the Soviets could be trusted, the communists could be trusted, they would play along, that we could have a one-world community. But now I believe that they believe, some of them believe at least, that maybe we can't trust the Soviets. We heard our president say this a month ago. He found out we couldn't trust the Soviets. Why? Well, first they went into Africa. They weren't supposed to go into Africa using Cuban troops. Second, they went into Afghanistan. They weren't supposed to do that. That's not a part of the One World Community plan. So now, these same people who have pushed us in this direction toward the One World Government, I feel some of them are getting scared because they're beginning to see that the Soviets have the power now, that if we do have a One World Government, it's likely to be a Soviet-run government.
And this is a concern for all of us.
That is.
Are you acquainted with the Council on Foreign Relations?
I'm not acquainted with them. I know what they are. They are the group who, ever since after World War I, have had a very strong, dominating influence in our government. They are the organization that started the Trilateral Commission, which, again, is an organization that is trying to push toward the One World Government through the economic route. The Council on Foreign Relations, again, are the instigators of the Declaration of Interdependence. Now, this is, to me, a very key document. And actually, I got interested in the One World Government because I saw a copy of the Declaration of Interdependence only because I saw in the newspaper one day, or a veterans newspaper, an account where one of our congresswomen from Maryland, Marjorie Holt, had made a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives. And it was a very fiery speech. It didn't get covered in the Washington Post or the New York Times or anything like that. But this was in March of 1976 when I saw this. And she said that she had been invited to go to Philadelphia with other members of Congress to endorse a document which she felt was a very traitorous act, the most traitorous act that had happened in our government since the founding of our nation. That interested me. So I went to Mrs. Holt's office and I got a copy of this document. And I read it. It was unbelievable that these people who signed this or endorsed this would consider putting our Constitution subordinate to that of the United Nations. In other words, we would be giving up our freedoms, turning them over to the United Nations. We'd have to give up our nationalism. We would give up our flag. Old Glory would not be our flag anymore. We would not have a national flag because you have to give up nationalism in order to be a member of the One World Government community.
And how many members of our Congress and Senate backed this concept of interdependence?
Doctor, that is what really worried me because I looked at on the back pages and I found that 131 members of our Congress had endorsed this document.
The Declaration of Interdependence. And the death of America as a nation, simply merging it into a one-world government. Is there any spiritual component to the problems that we face today?
Yes, absolutely. I think the thing that has caused us the problem today in our nation, all the problems we have, is the lack of truth. I think truth is something we must get back to. I think our government must tell our people the truth. The American people must know the truth, and they are not told the truth today by many of our Congress and our administration in many cases. And until we know the truth, until we get back to the fundamentals that are taught in the Bible, until we get back to that fundamentalism, I don't think that we're going to go very far as a free nation. Our nation is based on our trust in God, because we say, in God we trust, that's our motto. But I think a lot of our leaders have forgotten this, have gotten clear away from it, and I think we must get back to it.
Well, if we continue along the same course we've been going, both as far as our military policy, our domestic policy, our international policy, if we follow the same course that we've followed for the past 20 years, what, in your opinion, is the outlook for the survival of America as a free nation?
We are headed for death or slavery. There's no other way that the communists are going to be satisfied. So I think our time is short. I think we have to turn around. I think we still have the time. I don't want to be too pessimistic.